The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest hosting for Desiree Shell. Today I'm here with David Dobbs, science writer, blogger for Wired.com, and author of Reef Madness, Charles Darwin, Alexander Agassiz, and the Meaning of Coral. Hi, David, and welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm glad to have you here. And I wanted to just jump in, actually, and start talking about Reef Madness. One of the things that first caught my attention, actually, about the book is that it's about a different Agassiz than I would have expected. The story is mainly about Alexander Agassiz and not his much more famous father, naturalist Louis Agassiz, who himself had a long dispute with Darwin as well. Why Alexander?
I wrote about Alexander partly because his was the very strange story I ran across while finishing up another book. And what I found was this son of Louis, Alexander, spent much of the 19th century struggling with kind of the central questions and disputes of 19th century science, which were two. One, what is the nature of empiricism? And the other big question was the issue of natural selection that Darwin had brought up. And he spent much of his life dealing with those, but dealing with them sort of by proxy. He had to deal with the legacy of the two giants of science, of Victorian science, which is Charles Darwin, and another one, the biggest figure in American science during the 19th century was Louis Agassiz, who happened to be Alexander's father. These are two really different people. One was essentially a careful radical, that would be Charles Darwin, and the other was a radical conservative, that was Louis. And they were fighting over not just natural selection and their individual scientific legacies, but they were really fighting over how science should be done. And that was a question that Alexander very much wanted to answer correctly, honestly. He, like Darwin, wanted to help define a reliable sort of empiricism that freed science from allegiance to an idealist vision of how to do science, the idealist vision that Alex's father, Louis, had followed. And his attempt to do so while also trying to kind of reconcile and resolve the collision between Darwin and Louis that had ruined Louis's life was a really complicated and moving story, I found. So that's why I looked at Alex, because it was another way to look at this really critical period in the history of science when science very self-consciously made a final effort to leave a sort of idealist brand of science that was still tied to describing God's work. They wanted to leave that behind and just look at what was in front of them and be true to it.
Yeah, I really thought, I mean, on the surface, it's a story about coral, but it seems like underneath, really, it's a story about the nature of evidence and the relationship between evidence and explanations. Am I sort of right in thinking that?
Absolutely. It was about that. It was about what is a legitimate theory. How do you know a legitimate theory when you see one? How do you generate a legitimate theory? And this was a huge deal at the time, because before, at least in the natural history and the human realm, to explain where we came from, the generation of species, the answer was that you were, most scientists agreed, you were describing the work of God, that was your job. But after Darwin, the job of everyone in the biological sciences was to describe the origin of species, how all the animals that are around, well, all the plants too, let's not leave anyone out, how all the forms of life came to be. And this was a very different and harder question that involved a new set of rules about how to come up with theory.
Well, in my experience, like talking about the nature of evidence and the nature of what's a good theory, while it's really important, that's not always the topic of the best story. That's kind of not the salacious bit of science that draws people in. Why was this such a compelling story? It really is a compelling story. How did you make it that way out of something that's really about the nature of science?
Well, yes. I mean, we've been just talking for the last few minutes about how this was about how to do science well. It was also about savage fights for status and to retain status, and about family feuds and family grudges, and about huge alliances within both the British and the American scientific communities. They were partly fighting over how to do science well, but they were also fighting about, well, old rivalries between each other and among themselves, jockeying for position. Louis's resistance to Darwin's idea was partly an effort to save himself, to hold on to his claim as the premier scientist of America. He wanted to be Louis, Alex's father. He wanted to be the premier, the first naturalist of his era, as he said when he was quite young, still in his teens. And he dedicated his life to achieving just that. And just at the moment when it seemed he may have accomplished that, he was confronted with Darwin's, a very different answer from Darwin as to how species were created. Louis asked how, what is a species? He said, a species is a thought of God. And he became rich and very famous, proselytizing that vision of species. When Darwin came along and said, no, a species is the end product of a random series of chance events. It's a matter of selection, blind selection. Louis knew he either had to absorb that, which would be hard, given how hard he preached his own view, or defeat Darwin. So he dug in, and he fought, and he lost. Alex, his son, watched all of this. And while he took on Darwin's ideas about natural selection, he agreed with Darwin on how species were created. He understandably brought sort of a mixed, a very complicated set of emotions to Darwin's legacy. And that's, those complications would come into play when he himself questioned another theory of Darwin's, the theory of coral reefs.
I found that kind of really interesting how you characterized Alexander in comparison. Like, you start off at the beginning, we get a really quick introduction to Alexander, and it's not all that flattering. I think you actually describe him as dour and gruff. And then, the first couple chapters of the book are really about Louis and how grand he is, and his, as you said, his drive and his arrogance, and how he overextended himself. And by the time we meet Alexander, the adult Alexander, which is sort of right around this time that he's getting cut off at the knees by Darwin, by the time we meet him, he's very much a sympathetic character. And I think that leads to the way we interpret everything he does later on. How important was it for you to sort of consciously make that characterization?
It wasn't as if I tried to frame the story and decided to make him sympathetic. His story attracted me because he was sympathetic in sort of an odd way. He is easily the least colorful, the least dynamic of the three main figures in the book. But of course, the competition is ferocious. Louis was a spectacular figure. He gave lectures. He filled halls with 5,000 people. Sometimes they had to double the lectures. They had to give two in an evening because he was so popular. He spun this beautiful tale about how the patterns you find in nature, and he found all these examples, were that they were so patterned and there were so many similarities that this could only be the creation of a single mind, a single intelligence, that of God. And he spun this, it was just a gorgeous lecture by all accounts. And a man with a spectacular intelligence, an unbelievable memory. He was once asked about a specimen. He had originally studied in Paris. And 20 years later, when he was in the United States, he was asked about a particular fish that he had once studied. And he not only remembered the fish, he remembered the drawer at the Museum of Zoology in Paris that he'd looked at in this fish. He just was an unbelievable intellect and a very dashing, charming figure. And he was famous in a way that almost no scientist now is. I mean, that kind of his only close competition since his time has been Albert Einstein and maybe Carl Sagan. He was just a huge figure. And Darwin, of course, he was very dynamic and came to prominence in a subtler way, but he also was possessed of great charm. So here are the two legacies that Alexander is dealing with, and in a way they're both fathers to him. One is his literal father, and the other is the father of the brand of biology and science that Alex wants to pursue, a more empirical and insistence on evidence. And one of the many ironies of the tale is that he came to challenge Darwin on the basis of evidence about his coral reef theory. And you had in his challenge of Darwin, late in Darwin's life, about one of Darwin's earliest theories, you had reversed the situation. You had an agassiz against Darwin. The first time through, it was Louis Agassiz who had a beautiful story and no firm ties between the story and the evidence he liked to point to, and Darwin, who had spent 20 years collecting evidence to support his theory of natural selection. Later on, it's reversed. It's Darwin with the thin hand and Alexander with a huge pile of evidence challenging him. And he's challenging him about coral reef theories, but he's also challenging him about how to do science.
And then again, that's that important part of the story that really was about the nature of evidence and theory. Okay, as a science writer, I kept thinking of this as I was going through. You sort of compare Darwin, as you said, has all of this evidence, but you also talk about how he was really influenced by Lyell and Herschel, and that he was willing to speculate, that he was willing to sort of imaginatively think about an explanation, and then, as you said, diligently search for the evidence. And when it came to natural selection, he really emphasized all of that evidence. But Alexander still was very much an inductivist, as he emphasized in the story. He wanted all of, I think, his explanations to come from the data first. In writing a story about the history of science, which one do you think you're more like? Is it more sort of Herschel, you think of something and you're looking for evidence, or are you Alexander searching through the piles looking for an explanation?
Well, there's that tension, but I think you end up sort of where most scientists end up working. You're drawn to a few details that suggest a pattern, and then you gather evidence, and if early on, as you gather evidence, you realize that the pattern was an illusion, it didn't really exist, you just misread, or you saw just a handful of evidence, and you made a mistake. That story is not there. The story you thought was there doesn't exist. So you don't want to keep imposing that story on a bunch of evidence, on a bunch of facts about someone's life or era of history. You need to either change the story to fit the facts, or abandon it. And that's exactly what happened here. I was working on a book about fishery science, and one of Alexander's proteges I was studying, his name is Henry Bryant Bigelow, and he occupies the first 80 pages of my prior book, The Great Gulf. And there was just one line, one short paragraph about Bigelow going to the Maldive Islands out in the Indian Ocean with a senior figure, an aged Alexander Agassiz, whom I never heard of before. And he was there at the end of a 30-year mission, Agassiz was, to figure out the origin of coral reefs, and he never really quite published his entire theory. That's about all it said. And I thought, what on earth is going on there? So I started looking around, and indeed, there was this paradox, this man who had been obsessed with figuring out how coral reefs form, but never quite pulled the trigger on a comprehensive hypothesis. And that was the framework that everything else fell into, only everything else got far more complicated. So I think it is the same way. And one of the lessons of this book, and the thing that Alexander resisted, is that it's rare that you can simply accumulate facts and they declare their own order. You have to sort of impose an order on it at some point, and then test the facts you collect against that idea and either revise the idea or have it more or less proven out. And I think when you write nonfiction about things, you work in a similar manner.
Was it that waiting around that was part of him not publishing eventually, like waiting for something to emerge?
I think it was. This, you know, I have to speculate because he wrote a lot of letters, but they weren't terribly intimate. But, you know, over a lifetime, you could collect a lot about him. And his best friend, a man named Theo Lyman, he wrote a lot of letters and also kept diaries. And from Theo, you could actually learn a lot about Alex. So I think what part of what sort of inhibited Alex was the lessons he took from his father. His father was a very expansive man. He was never afraid to spin a spectacular story from limited evidence. And Alex saw him fall a long, long way because he had done so. Alex seemed to take from his father many lessons in negative form. He saw things as his, things that his father did, and it was clear that he decided, I am not going to make that mistake. And one of those was to tell too idealist a story, too bold a story that gets too far out in front of the evidence. But I think in the way that many people often do, he took the lesson too firmly and became too cautious about pulling out in front of the evidence. And that was partly by temperament. That was partly because he was reacting to the lesson set by his father. But it was also completely consistent with the kind of science that self-identified empiricists said they were trying to do at the time. Darwin himself claimed to be practicing the same sort of Baconian inductivism, where you just collected facts and then the pattern became apparent. But he wasn't. He was not practicing that kind of empiricism. He was deducing and then investigating.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with David Dobbs, science writer and blogger for Wired, where he writes about scientific culture, neuroscience, and more at Neuron Culture.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Schell. Today I'm talking to science writer David Dobbs about his book Reef Madness, Charles Darwin, Alexander Agassiz, and the Meaning of Coral. David's a writer and blogger and also the author of The Northern Forest with Richard Ober and The Great Gulf, Fishermen, Scientists, and a Struggle to Revive the World's Greatest Fishery. So we were just talking, I guess, a little bit about whether you were more like Darwin or more like Alex in the way that you as a writer use evidence. And you touched on the fact that writing a historical book has some real challenges. You really have to rely on what's available, letters and diaries and scientific publications. But, of course, you can't mostly go to your sources. You can't ask for firsthand accounts. In the book, in a couple of places, you're really explicit about there being several layers of interpretation between you and sort of the object of your story. Like when you're using stories from Alex's grandchildren and children. In writing historical stories about science, how important is it to be upfront about those layers of interpretation?
I think it's very important to be honest and fairly direct about how far along the, you know, sort of path of speculation you are about a given thing. In general, you have to infer things, of course. But I think in general, your interpretation, the story you tell, anything you state as fact, if you say, but Alex thought otherwise, you can't just be weak in that. You need to know he thought otherwise because of something he wrote or something that a reliable source, someone who knew him well and can be trusted, stated. If you need to speculate, as I did a minute ago, on why he behaved the way he did, why his inhibition against publishing, why did he never tell the whole story, why didn't he attack Darwin more directly, either before Darwin died or after. I think then you need to state that you're speculating. You might, in any number of ways, you can say one has to be careful here about Alexander's motivations, and then you have stated your disclosure. I'm speculating, just as a scientist needs to declare when they are speculating about evidence, as opposed to claiming a finding. You know, this is important to gain and keep the trust of readers and have them trust nonfiction.
Kind of another layer of that interpretation that you talk about is being clear that we have to understand or think and remember that these historical figures live in a different context, and they're going to interpret things differently, or things are going to have a different meaning for them. And in a couple of spots, you make that clear. You know, you say things like, that might seem idyllic to us from our perspective, but, and sort of go on to explain how it might have, what it might have meant for Alex or for Charles Darwin. Can you think of any instance in this book or in historical stories in general where that's a really particularly important reminder?
It's a little sticky. I think if you've set the context up right and explained what's different about the era and the main forces that are going on in the era, then the reader will contextualize a lot of that themselves, so that you sort of need to call special attention now and then when something sticks out as particularly odd, or when its oddness rises from a context that you haven't yet explained. I hope the reader of this book recognizes by the time I get to explaining Alex's dilemma how powerful the two impulses were. The long tradition of idealist natural science, in which a taxonomist like Louis was describing God's order when he categorized animals. He was identifying something as specifically of a certain species, and that species was a permanent thing. It was a thought of God that never changed. As opposed to later, and I explain this, that Darwin's view of species, the boundaries are fuzzier. And that, you know, if you push it far enough, they're almost arbitrary because there's transitions between species, and of course the species themselves are all changing. So if I've done my work properly, the reader understands those tensions. And if I've described the rise and the roots of empiricism and the empirical impulse, then the reader can understand why Alex, along with that and his aversion to what he'd seen his father do, why he is inductivist to a fault, as it were.
Thinking about that historical context and the broader social context at the time, we actually have a question from the website. This is from Michael.
Darwin's story has been told time and time again. Can you give advice for how to write about Darwin without seeming repetitive?
Well, I think, you know, find some fresh things. And one of the delights of finding this story, this is kind of the easy answer, is find a part that no one's written about. Hardly anyone knows about this story of coral reefs. And my delight in discovering it via Alex's strange reluctance was to see that this huge thing in Darwin's life, because this coral reef issue was huge to Darwin. It was enormous. It can hardly be overstated how important this was to him personally and professionally. So the short answer is find an episode that no one's written about. Now, I don't know where that is in Darwin's life right now, but it helps if you can find a different aspect of it. Tom Levinson had a nice book a couple of years ago about Newton and the counterfeiter, which was, I didn't know this, Newton for a while ran the Mint. He was kind of the equivalent of the Secretary of the Treasury, and he became obsessed with finding counterfeiters. And so it was this whole, you know, Newton as sort of cop. So if you can find something like that, you can tie it to other goings on in the scientific world, but also tell a new sort of personal story. And what I loved about this story from I mean, it's a very telling story about Alex. And Alex, in a sense, is the poor sucker who walked into one of the most difficult arguments in the history of science and had to try to figure it out. And he didn't quite figure it out, partly because he lacks that special thing, the genius in Darwin or the genius in his father, a different sort of genius. So he's more like us. At the same time, we see in this story a Darwin that is easy to overlook, that we usually don't attend to. This is Darwin, who formed a bold theory very early in his life, the coral reef theory, that made him as a scientist. He published this as soon as he got back from the Beagle. It won him his first major paper. It won him entrance into the Royal Society. It won him entrance into the inner circles of British science. And he did it because he was crazy. He was a lunatic for geology. He was completely over the top. This was a surprise to me. He thought of himself as a geologist, not a zoologist. He took 1,400 pages of geology notes on the Beagle voyage. And if I remember correctly, 400 of about zoology. This is all he thought about all night and day. He was so excited. He wrote from the Andes to his sister that it is a pleasure much like gambling. Now, what does this mean? He liked to play cards when he was in college. He was gambling. He was looking at his cards and making a bet. That's what he was doing with this coral reef theory. And that hand played out pretty well for him. But there was another hand that he played about geology just after that went bad. It was a different theory about this geological features up in Scotland. And he was wrong. Rather, he was proven wrong by Louis Agassiz. This is early in his career, and it was a horrible moment for him. And here I'm speculating, but I suspect that it made him quite nervous about his coral reef theory.
I can imagine it did. Those are two good images, Newton as cop and Darwin as gambler.
Yeah,
it's really evocative.
No, it was delightful reading about this young. He was very directionless during college. He played a lot of cards and he spent a lot of time shooting. He loved to shoot more than anything. And he really didn't have much sense of direction until he got invited to go on this trip, which at first he wasn't going to go on. Then someone changed his mind. But and the reason he wanted to go on that was because he'd read other. He was in love with the kind of romance of the travel, and this led to this wonderful career. And it was Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, which Darwin read on the journey out towards South America, that really fired him up about science and opened the door in many ways to Darwin's own first important theory, which was the theory of coral reefs, which he dreamed up before he'd ever seen one, looking at charts while he was still on the west coast of South America. It was as deductive and speculative a theory just about as you could make.
We have another question that was almost the same question I was just going to ask. We have a question from Jeff.
Why did Agassiz disappear from the history of science?
And I wonder, I guess the part I was thinking of is, does it have something to do with not being a character in that way? We can't call him a gambler or a cop or a... you know, something really imaginative like that. Is that part of why he's been lost from the history?
Well, it's odd. I think that's a big part of it. It's also because the coral reef question, as they called it, or the coral reef problem, as they called it in the Victorian era, and then second half of the 19th century, was actually an argument that lasted for over 150 years. It had started by 1810, and it did not end until 1953. And the heart of it was this sort of cat and mouse, very polite argument between Alexander and Darwin. And then soon after Darwin died, a much more ferocious fight between people aligned with Darwin and other people who, in British science mainly, who hated Darwin's theory of natural selection. And many of them hated Darwin. And so it blew up in the late 1880s and 1890s, and was a big deal. And that was partly because they were hashing over the methodological and sort of philosophy of science methods that had driven the theory of natural selection, the argument over the origin of species. But that kind of tailed off, and by the time Alexander died in 1910, the argument over coral reefs was that it was kind of at a draw. Neither Darwin's theory or Agassiz's theory, which was also known as Murray's theory, his friend John Murray, an oceanographer. If you look in the 1911 Britannica, which is written by the most prominent geologist in the United States, the entry on coral reefs is, and he's basically calling it a draw, that it appears that some of the reefs in the world are created by subsidence, which was Darwin's theory, that coral reefs grew on islands that were sinking in the ocean, and a more complicated, multifaceted answer that Alexander offered. It was a draw. And it remained a draw until 1953, when finally scientists working out in the Pacific, some U.S. scientists, finally could drill deep enough in a coral island to answer the question definitively. So it went on and on and on, and by then, the coral reef question was not a big deal. So I think it is partly because of the sort of anticlimactic long denouement of the argument, and also because Alex was not a flashy, colorful figure. He was too careful to be exciting, sort of.
Right.
which is supposed to be a great scientific virtue, but it's not great for getting famous.
Right, not great for revolutionizing and becoming known for your theory, I guess.
He's like most scientists.
Yeah, that's right. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with David Dobbs, science writer, blogger at Wired.com, and author of the forthcoming book, The Orchid and the Dandelion. So we've been talking a little bit about some of the decisions that you made in writing Reef Madness, talking about interpretation. One of the most interesting decisions for me, though, was your choice to serialize portions of it kind of over the past year on your blog. Can you tell me a little bit about why you decided to do that?
Because I could.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah, it started when, let's see, someone had published something about Asa Gray. Asa Gray was a Harvard botanist who played a key role in a series of debates about Darwin's Origin of Species. Asa took Louis Agassiz apart in the spring of 1860, and Agassiz's reputation, Louis's, was never the same afterwards. And Asa Gray was a very interesting figure. And at Atlantic, Alexis Madrigal published a long essay of Asa Gray's, because it was some anniversary that had originally run in the Atlantic. And I thought, oh, well, this is a good time to show this kind of portrait of Asa Gray and the story of how he came, even though he's a devout Christian, to take Darwin's side and fight Louis. And once I published that, then the thought was, well, why not publish more? So I went backwards and started publishing from the book's beginning. And I guess I've published about halfway through at this point.
Actually, talking about that being in the Atlantic, I noticed that throughout the book that there was this back and forth of them publishing in sort of Proceedings of the Royal Society, but they also published in the Atlantic and in Nature, which you point out at the time was a more sort of broad audience publication. Do you think that that had an influence on the tone of the discussion or the way that the argument played out?
Well, I think it did, and it underlined that it was a more public argument than you're used to seeing. I mean, there's a couple of issues that get argued in public these days. It's hard to imagine the coral reef issue getting argued in public these days, but it did then. But again, it was partly because the figures involved that it became such a big deal in Britain. But there was a ferocious, you know, in the 1890s, this thing with this fellow, the Duke of Argyll, against Thomas Huxley. It would be, I'm not going to be able to find the right figures, but as if Richard Dawkins and someone else got in a long argument right now about some matter of geology, because it's really a proxy for another argument. But I think it was also that if you read those old issues of Nature or any other late 19th century scientific publication, the publications are far less dry than they are now. You know, a regular person is much better able to understand them. They've become less formalized, and you can actually use the first person. It's much friendlier, accessible writing.
Yeah, I noticed that. A lot of the quotes that you pulled out were really engaging and, yeah, as you say, more informal. There was sort of personal language and some really colorful descriptive language too.
It's happened since then that, and my somewhat sketchy history is that a lot of it happened after the Second World War, that the journals have sort of dried up. And there's a lot of different reasons for that. It seems more concise, but it is also because people mistake dryness for authority, I think. And it's a loss. Now and then you see a paper written now that has some voice to it. And every single time it's a pleasure because it's so rare.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with David Dobbs, science writer and blogger for Wired, where he writes about scientific culture, neuroscience, and more at Neuron Culture.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're talking about how global connectivity and the rise of big data are transforming the way we look at knowledge. We're joined by David Weinberger, co-director of Harvard's Library Innovation Lab, to talk about his book, Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. And we'll speak to Lindsay Pinto, communications manager of openmedia.ca, about their work to safeguard a free and open internet for Canadians. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Schell. Today I'm talking to science writer David Dobbs about his book Reef Madness, Charles Darwin, Alexander Agassiz, and the Meaning of Coral. David is the author of several compelling stories about the people and processes of science, such as Free Science, One Paper at a Time, the story of a son's struggle to make publicly available his father's scientific papers. So we were just talking about how the language of scientific papers has changed, and you used the term drying up. Do you think there's actually a bit of a change going on now that more scientific communication is perhaps happening in online venues?
Well, I think it might. I mean, you see when someone like Jonathan Eisen or Dan MacArthur or Joe Pickerel, these are all geneticists, that after they publish them, first of all, their papers are fairly, you know, they're lucid and they're not simple to read because it's highly technical information, but the parts that aren't highly technical, they're cleanly written. But more important, they are going to their blogs and writing extensive accounts of it, explanations of it to people like, well, to regular old interested readers to make sense of and to contextualize it, to put their findings in context. And this is a wonderful, wonderful step. And, you know, I am sympathetic to the argument that that should virtually be a requirement for publication of the quote unquote scientific paper. That there should be a separate lay reader's account that is true. You know, it's a fairly full explanation without all the details. But when you finish reading it, you know what the paper's about, and you understand why it's important in the field. So I do think that blogs and other online fora have a chance to loosen up the idiom, and you know, maybe that'll start to bleed over into some of the actual journal papers as well. That'd be nice.
Yeah, sort of bring some of that kind of communication back to the journals.
Yeah, I think it's important because then, you know, if people feel walled off from the science just because they can't even understand the papers, you know, it doesn't ultimately serve science well and its place in the culture.
That makes sense. Actually, sort of speaking of tone, you wrote a pretty scathing book review recently about a book sort of putting forward a possible theory, I guess you could say. And it got a lot of attention. It was really widely shared. A lot of people talked about it. Why do you think that kind of science book review resonated with people so much?
You know, I'm not quite sure. I was a little surprised at how much attention that thing got. We're talking about a review of, I wrote of Smile, which was a TED book. This is for a site called Download the Universe that my colleague, Carl Zimmer started. He organized about 15 or so science writers to review books about science that were only ebooks, because we realized it was very hard to find these otherwise. And I came across one published by Ted Books, Ted.
Yeah.
That Ted, yeah.
Of the TED Talks.
Of the TED Talks, right. And it's called Smile, the Astonishing Power of a Simple Act. And I looked at the talk, and, you know, the talk was pretty interesting. It was 7 minutes, and it was about, it alluded to some studies, and this was going to be about kind of the science behind what happens when you smile or are smiled at. And I write about behavioral science, and there's, you know, there's a lot going on when we talk to each other. But the book was, I was not happy with the book. And I wrote it, I think there was definitely a lot of people who feel that TED Talks often go too far. I think saw this as a pushback. And I think just a grumpy review about smiling. That seemed to take people. And then the sentence that everyone really liked was that he turns to science to explain the smile, and he finds many studies, but apparently few commas. People loved this for some reason. And then there's a sentence that I quote him where it needed some commas, but didn't have them.
Yes, fair enough. Well, I kind of saw some resonance in there in the way that both Agassiz and Darwin and their contemporaries were really not afraid to talk about both the rhetoric and the theories. So you had a chance to add a bit of that.
And this, you know, this touches on something again. There's to me one thing I learned and really saw. There's two big things that stand out as lessons from the Agassiz book for me. And I think that anyone can get if they go all in on a juicy story from the history of science. And it's easier to see it because it's not of your time. One is that science is really personal. People do it. They bring everyone's work is really personal, right? People bring all kinds of personal agendas to it, much of it unconsciously. The other is that it's taking place within a huge kind of changes and forces, cultural forces, changes and differences about in the philosophy of science, if it's science. A lot of these too, sort of, they're so saturated into the culture that you're not aware of them at the time. But if you look back at a time, you can see them because, you know, they've come out. And the final thing is this tension, and this is kind of the heart of the story, in science, between doing science that is sticking as close to the facts as possible, the most parsimonious, conservative possible explanation of the facts that everyone can agree on one hand, and on the other, the most expansive, imaginative, bold, aggressive explanation or theory that can be reconciled with the facts that everyone can agree on. And this is going on all the time. And I think we can all agree that when someone gets way too far out in front so that they're not really attached to the facts anymore, or they simply fail to bother making plausible connections, then it's worth tripping them up.
And that's where things kind of fall apart, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Another really striking feature in the book for me was the analogies that you use. At one point, Louis is like a music teacher imploring his students to feel the music. And I think later on, Alex is a lucky gumshoe who stumbles across a misread clue. You use these really kind of playful analogies. How important do you think those are to communicating about science?
I think analogies and metaphors and, you know, models, I think those are really important. Science can be difficult, and I think any apt analogy or metaphor, the value of it is it lets you simply frame a set of facts in a second way. And one in this case, that sort of echoes the distinctions being made by scientists, but is more accessible to the lay reader. But I think anytime you pick an apt metaphor for something, I mean, that's the whole point of it. You abstract it a little bit, but put it in different terms. And if you've done your work well, that is, that illuminates the subject a bit, that lets you see it with the light cast from a slightly different direction, so you understand its dimensions better.
And you've used music as an analogy more than just in this book and more than just for Louis. You've recently done a couple of talks and some writing about connections between musical structure and the structure we use to write about science. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I started thinking in musical terms of musical form and structure while I was writing this book. I was trying to figure out how many sections to chop it up into and then how to subdivide those sections and how to create senses of movement. And I was taking about the time I started this book, I started to take the violin, which is, it's a hard thing to learn, but my teacher was very, very big on understanding the structure of a piece of music that you were playing. So, you know, the first thing he'd do is put the music on the stand and he'd say, put the bow down, we're going to walk through this piece and see how it's structured here. Because you can't play a single note properly well with meaning unless you understand how it fits within the larger structure. And of course, within the measure it's in, it's, you know, structure is a fractal thing. And so he had me think about musical structure it wasn't a big leap to think, well, how can this help me in writing, a kind of a model. So I started to read up a bit on musical structure and see how they divide things up. I was already in the habit of thinking in terms of like theatrical structure, how you can, you know, there's three acts and in a three act play, there's a sort of, not a formula, but you know, it's common to do different things at different times. So I wanted to see how they do that in music, and it proved really helpful to me in doing this piece. And it's just sort of stuck with me. And soon after I finished the book, it actually helped me solve a really hard compositional problem, structural problem in a magazine feature I wrote for the Times Magazine that had three different elements that I had to weave in, you know, my 5,500 words that I was allowed. And this one particular piece of music that I was playing at the time, in a quartet, a Schubert quartet, the first movement of it actually served as a model for how to weave the lines, because it was about two musical ideas that kept getting juxtaposed and clashing. And so that's some of what's in my talk, is I play these pieces of music along with some Led Zeppelin. I mean, I don't play them on the violin. I wouldn't inflict that on people. But but I find
it would be fun.
It's sort of like, you know, we were talking about metaphors, how they can sort of just, by abstracting something, it can let you grapple with it a different way, because yeah, you tend to don't get bogged down in the same details. I think structure, music for me, works as a way to think about how to structure a story. I could see how if you, someone who played a lot of chess, how you might think your way through a story in terms of how a chess game goes or something like that.
But for you, music works. That's really neat that you say that it came to you during this book, because I noticed right at the beginning that the chapters are broken up into pretty short sections. And I noticed it a lot reading, say, the first chapter, and then completely forgot about it, because it worked really well. It sort of flowed you through in a really great structure. And it wasn't until the very end I looked back and thought, oh yeah, the chapters were all broken up. I'd forgotten about that. But it worked so well, I didn't even notice by the end.
Well, good. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad it didn't kind of jump out at you. No, I think you have to, you know, these chapters, some of them are 6,000 words long, some of them a little longer. You want, you know, a little numbered break within a chapter is just one way you can sort of declare the structure to the reader. And the, you know, structure, it's not just dividing things up. It's different pieces serve different functions. And if you're doing it right, that actually creates a tension that moves the story along and that can be resolved later.
Cool. I like that. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with David Dobbs, science writer, blogger, and author. And I also know that you're work on a new book called The Orchid and the Dandelion. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. This is about sort of how genes that we've seen as bad are maybe good for you. it's really about a recasting of a view of genes that seem to underlie, that have been identified as underlying a lot of things that haunt us the most: madness, depression, melancholy, aggression. These are genes that have been tied to those moods or behavioral problems. And that if a fresh look at the study of these genes and how they behave in how people who carry them react to different environments suggests that they're not just downsides, these genes, gene variants. That if you have them and your life is not terribly stressful, you'll actually do better in whatever realm is being measured. So they're not risk genes, in other words. They're not about vulnerability. They're about sensitivity to experience. And that changes a lot. It changes how we think of mental illness and whether a tendency to depression is strictly just a bad thing, or is it part of a sensitivity that also can bring you pleasure and that you yourself can leverage into good things. So that's what this book is about, and it's also about some of the things we've been talking about how far can you push an idea, the tension between the most parsimonious explanation and one a little bit more expansive.
Yeah, is there the same kind of tension, like the inductive-deductive tension, in something like this? Because it is, in a way, so new, approaching these problems this way.
Yeah, no, it is. These are people, this is a fairly, I wouldn't call it a radical idea, but it's a fairly expansive idea. In some ways, it's bold. And at the same time, it's taking place at a time. I mean, they're doing this work at a time where genetics and genomics is changing a lot. And there's a lot of discussion about what's the best way to go about seeing how the best way to look into the question of how genes give rise to behavior or mood. Mm-hmm. So, all those are the undercurrents. And meanwhile, there's the very power of this idea, which is, if you're prone to some of these problems, if you're prone to depression, for instance, and it's been painted for years as a genetic vulnerability that makes you that way, and suddenly the genetic vulnerability is being painted not as just a vulnerability. This is a double, it's a bidirectional effect. It can be vulnerable, but you can also leverage it, because anything you do to make your own environment better, you'll actually get more lift from. It's a very different framing of the roots of, melancholy, say.
Yeah.
And that I'm talking to people who are dealing with that, this reframing, and it really does color their own view of their lives differently.
I can imagine it would. In that kind of study, what would you say is the sort of key kind of evidence? What's the key thing that someone would be looking for?
Well, I think, this hypothesis or theory, its test will be, will there be multiple lines of converging evidence that support this?
Right.
I think that's what's going to give this legs. I mean, it already seems to have legs. Its influence is really grown tremendously since I started the book. I just went to, I see now when I travel to universities to give talks or whatnot, 3 years ago, it was rare to run into researchers who were looking at genes, environment, and behavior through this frame. They were still, most of the work is still being done under the vulnerability model. Now, it's very common. So they're looking at plasticity, not vulnerability. So it's already gaining a lot of influence. In that sense, it has legs. But, will it hold up? How robustly will it hold up? And as we advance in our ability to see how genes affect us, to kind of find the mechanisms that run downstream from having a gene variant, will that work support this idea? I think that's what's going to be the real test of it. And, it's not my job to sort of adjudicate how true it is. And I'm not sure that'll be, unambiguously resolved before I finish the book, and that's okay.
It's really interesting looking back at the changing, talking about those facts and the connection there between the evidence they'd be looking for and what you're really talking about in the book. And I think in our last moments here, I have one more question from the chat that relates directly to that. This is a question from Greg.
What is the single most important fact, or set of facts, that would have changed everybody's understanding of coral reefs during this period of overlap between Darwin and Alexander?
Well, the thing they were after, that was a difficult thing. I was just talking about how this question I'm looking into, it's going to depend on converging lines of evidence. But they knew all along that the people looking into it, they knew that if they could drill deep enough in a coral reef, they would know the answer. Because by Darwin's account, the reefs, the foundation of the reef had been sinking for eons, and the coral building atop it so that the coral would be very thick. And by Agassiz's account, no, most reefs would just have a relatively thin cap of coral atop something else. But they couldn't get out and drill these reefs. At first, they didn't have the technology. Agassiz tried, but the drilling stuff just wasn't up to it. And then during the first part of the 20th century, most of it was not politically comfortable, let's say, to go out in the Pacific and drill because the Japanese didn't really like it. That was resolved with the Second World War. They also had the drilling technology. So they went out and they drilled and found the answer. So this was part of the problem, was it was theoretically testable, falsifiable. But as a practical matter, they had a hard time falsifying it for 150 years.
Ah, so they knew what the key piece of evidence was. They just really couldn't get it.
They did. And Darwin, mm-hmm. in a remarkable exchange of letters with Alexander the year before Darwin died, he sort of teased Alexander. He said, I wish some doubly rich millionaire would take a state-of-the-art drilling rig out in the Pacific and resolve this thing once and for all. Now, this was kind of a funny thing, really, because Alexander Agassiz was trebly rich. He was one of the richest people in the world because he'd solved a problem in a copper mine that he had an interest in. So he spent a lot of money, and he tried to do exactly what Darwin had suggested, but the drilling equipment wasn't up to the kind of depths that they needed.
Yeah, he was fascinating that way, both a really successful and sound engineer as well as a scientist.
Yeah, no, a very capable man, and his business contacts did not realize he was a great scientist, and most of his scientific contacts did not realize that he was a filthy rich copper magnate. So, I mean, this is how quiet a guy he was. If Louis was all that, you'd have known about it very quickly.
Yeah, we'd all still know about it.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much, David, for talking to me today. It's been really great to chat with you about Alex and Louis and Darwin, as well as a little bit about science writing and more. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we've included links to David's book and blog on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And if you're there, maybe click the links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and Google+ to get program updates, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, listen to past episodes, and leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who, I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.